Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. As I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money, major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 0.035% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
I'm
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he...
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And
but we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done.
Hmm.
I, coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their.
I say people are starting to ask me why. Why I never laugh.
I don't laugh no more and I don't smile at all. At all. At all.
Unselfishly, you and me, all the love is living. All right, time for another installment of It's My House. Today, we've been doing Slave Entrepreneur Month, and we also mentioned Black Towns History Month. And today we're going to focus in, because we've been doing mostly individuals for this month of February 2022. But today, and I think this is the last day in... Wait a minute. Let me look at the calendar here. Today, the title that we have is Freedmanstown, USA. Freedmanstown, USA. And let's get into it, because we've been covering mostly individuals. So, and I've been going through Wikipedia every day. So you can join along as well. Now, Freedmanstown, spelled F-R-E-E-D-M-E-N, apostrophe S, Freedmanstown, or should I say Freedman's Towns, because there were multiple. In the United States, and once again I'm going from Wikipedia, in the United States, a Freedmanstown was an African-American municipality or community built by freedmen, former slaves who were emancipated during and after the Civil War. These towns emerged in a number of states, most notably Texas. A lot of people say Oklahoma. I would say Oklahoma might be number two, but Texas. And in our scrolling marquee today, you'll see where there were probably at least 500 of these Freedmanstowns or black townships in the state of Texas alone. They basically dwarf everybody, including Oklahoma. They were also known as freedom colonies from the title of a book by Sitton and Conrad. All right, let's go into, well, before we go into that, let's go into this word freedman. You know, what's a freedman? I was born at Freedman's Hospital. Okay. Freedman, a freedman, one word, or freed woman, one word, is a formerly enslaved person who has been released from slavery, usually by legal means. Historically, enslaved people were freed by manumissions, granted freedom by their captor owners. Emancipation, granted freedom as part of a larger group, or, now this is a very important one, self-purchase. Self-purchased. All right. A fugitive slave is a person who escaped enslavement by fleeing. All right, then they get into ancient Rome, Arabian and Northern African slavery. All right, United States. In the United States, the term freedman or freedwoman referred chiefly to former slaves emancipated during and after the Civil War by the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment. Slaves freed before the war, usually by individual manumission, and what is manumission? Manumission or enfranchisement is the act of freeing slaves by their owners. Different approaches, two very critical words here, different approaches to manumissions were developed. Just what I, when I talk about, what do you call it, reparations, there are different methods of reparations. And a lot of those methods have absolutely nothing to do with government. But anyway, let me get back to manumission or enfranchisement. Each specific, or the different approaches to manumissions were developed, each specific to the time and place of a particular society. This can be applied to the topic of reparations as well. Thorian Vereen Shepherd states that the most widely used term is gratuitous manumission. All right, we had to have a whole show just on that. All right, now, in the United States, when it comes to freedmen and freed women, let's see. Okay, now here we go. The term freedman and freedman, I mean freed woman, or women, freedmen or free women, refer chiefly to the former slaves emancipated during and after the Civil War. We got that. The great majority of families of free people of color recorded in the U.S. Census in the Upper South and in the first two decades after the Revolutionary War have been found to have descended from the unions between white women, indentured servants, or free, and black men, whether indentured servant, slave, or free in colonial Virginia. According to the legal principle of partus sequentur venturing in the slave colonies, later states, children were born into a social status of their mother. Thus, mixed-race children of white women were born free. Such free families of color tended to migrate to the frontier of Virginia and the Upper South colonies, and then west to Kentucky, of the future West Virginia and Tennessee. In addition, the first two decades after the Revolution, slaveholders freed thousands of slaves in the Upper South inspired by the revolutionary ideals. Most northern states abolished slavery, some on a gradual basis. In Louisiana and other areas of the former New France, free people of color were classified in French, and I'm not even going to begin to read that Latin. They were generally born to black or mixed race mothers and white fathers of ethnic French and or European ancestry. The fathers sometimes freed their children and sexual partners, leading to the growth of the community of Creoles of color. And there's a whole article on that. Or free people of color. New Orleans had the largest community of free people of color, well established before the U.S. acquired Louisiana. The French and Spanish colonial rulers had given the free people of color more rights than most of the blacks in the American South. In addition, there were sizable communities of free people of color in the French Caribbean colonies such as Saint Dominique, now Haiti, and Guadeloupe. Due to the violence of the Haitian Revolution, many free people of color who were originally part of the revolution fled the island as refugees after being attacked by slave rebels, particularly in the north end of the island. Some went first to Cuba, from where they immigrated to New Orleans in 1808 and 1809. After being expelled by Napoleon, when, after being expelled, when Napoleon invaded Spanish territory in Europe, many brought slaves with them. The numbers strengthened the French-speaking community of enslaved black people, as well as free people of color. Other refugees from St. Dominique settled in Charleston, South Carolina, and New York. For you ADOs people who want reparations, see, that's why one of the things, and I never hear anybody bring up this term or this profession, you're going to need a slave investigator to really track. It's not, you want one of these ancestral, you know, throw some spit in it and mail it to them, that's not going to cut it. You're going to need a reparations investigator. That's expensive. You're going to need an investigator, and I'm not even going to go into a lawyer who specializes in reparations law. But you're going to need those two. Well, out of the two, the most important one to start off with is you're going to need a reparations investigator. Because this stuff goes way back. I mean, do you want Haiti to cut the check? Do you want France to cut the check? If you want it in a check form. Because as I just read a few minutes ago, you know, manumissions, the freeing of slaves, there were many different ways to do it. And this is all without government intervention. But then you got a bunch of folks that are sitting in front of Congress trying to milk that cow. Interesting that you haven't had a reparations investigator on none of those panels yet. But that's another whole thing there. All right. Okay. Now, there's a lot more information on freedmen and freedwomen. It's all on Wikipedia. All right. Let's get back to Freedman Sound. In the United States, a Freedman Sound was an African-American municipality or community built by freedmen. We went through that. Also known as Freedom Colonies. The Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment brought 4 million people out of slavery to the defunct Confederate States of America, plus 4 border slave states that did not succeed. Many freed people were forced with the questions of where would they go? What would they eat, and how would they survive? I kind of find that sentence kind of strange because these same people, we'll catch that in a minute. Many decided to remain on the plantations working as sharecroppers. Many freedmen migrated from white areas to build their own towns away from white supervision. They also created their own churches and civic organizations. Freedmen settlements had a greater measure of protection from the direct effects of Jim Crow. Such places were defensive communities where black property owners had circled the wagons against outsiders, a fortress without walls. Freedmen settlements were black enclaves that kept to themselves until the end of Jim Crow. Few whites wished or dared to live there. Education was of the highest priority of these residents of Freedman's towns. They started schools which both adults and children attended to learn to read and write. By 1915, schools built in the Freedman settlements were mostly small frame 1 to 2 room structures. Textbooks for the schools were typically donated from white schools, but often they were in poor condition. Teachers were very serious about discipline, which was strictly enforced by switching students, can't do that today, with a brush, or making them stand in the corner on one leg. Can't do that today either. All right. We're going to run through a list of some of these freedmen's towns. In Alabama. Now, I'm on Wikipedia still. And I'm not going to read you the complete list because not even Wikipedia in this particular section, they don't even list them all. But just to give you an idea, in Alabama, you had Africatown and Hobson City. In Arizona, you had Mobile, Arizona, and Randolph. These were all freedmen's towns or black towns. Okay. In California, you have Allensworth. In Canada, you have North Buxton, Ontario. Colorado, you had Deerfield, which that's a ghost town now. Florida, you had Eatonville, Fort Moses, Freetown, and you had Rosewood. But anyway, we're going to have to bring on Lizzie Jenkins back here again, so because she's a Rosewood experience, so you need to hear from her, the real deal on Rosewood. Anyway, Illinois, you had Brooklyn, which we've talked about Brooklyn before, which was formed by Mother Priscilla Baltimore and 11 families, Lakeview and New Philadelphia, which is now a historical site, but also you have Pembroke and Hopkins Park, but that's not listed on this particular list. Indiana, you had the Beach Settlement, spelled B-E-E-C-H Settlement, Roberts Settlement, let's see. Kansas, you had Nicodemus. Kentucky, you had Huntertown. Louisiana, you had Mossville and Scotlandville. In Maine, you had Harbor Island. Maryland, they list Unionville. Now, let me fill in the blanks with Maryland. You also have Highland Beach, Maryland, which was formed by Frederick Douglass and his daughter-in-law, Laura Douglass. They were turned away from a motel because they were black. So instead of marching and protesting, what they did is they bought 40, their way of protesting and their way of marching, I'll put it that way, is they marched to the local real estate office or whoever was selling land, beachfront land in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. They marched there. And they protested by buying a 40-acre tract of land and starting their own town. That's real marching and protesting. So that's in Maryland. You have North Brentwood, Maryland, which is a black township. This is all right outside of D.C., by the way, at least North Brentwood is. Highland Beach, Maryland, is in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. You have Fairmount Heights, and I think you have Glendale. All those were started by black folk. All right, I grew up in those areas, man, and I didn't know until like years after I got out of college that what was the deal, you know, with those places. You also had up in Montgomery County, Maryland, near Poolsville, Maryland, they had a community called Sugarland. I don't think it still exists, but it might, because they do have a historian up there. In Massachusetts, you had Parting Ways. Mississippi, you had Davis Bend and Mount Bayou. Missouri, you had Kinchlow, Meacham Park, North Webster, Pennytown, and Roberts. And I think, like I said, this isn't a complete list. Nebraska had Dinwiddie. New Jersey had Marshalltown. New Mexico, you had Blackdom and Vado. New York, you had Eastville, which is part of Sag Harbor, New York. Freetown, New York. Sandy Ground. Seneca Village. Seneca Village was a town built on about 4 or 5 acres. But the city took it over by eminent domain for Central Park. Weeksville in North Carolina, you had Bethania, Haiti, James City. Hold it, wait a minute. What do we have here? Okay. Princeville, Roanoke Island. In Oklahoma, you have Boley, Brooksville, Clearview, Grayson, Langston, Lima. Who's calling me? Oh, somebody wants a place to stay. Langston, Lima, Redbird, Renniesville, Summit. I've been to Summit. Taft, been to Taft. Tatums, Tallahassee. I've been there. Vernon and apparently a place called Greenwood located in Tulsa. Let me read about that. Or, you know, Eric, Greenwood was actually a 40-acre neighborhood. But anyway, that comes under Freedman's Colony. South Carolina, you got Mitchellville, Tennessee. You got Free Hill. And in Texas, now, Texas, they had upwards of 500 Freedman's towns at one point. Here's some of them. They don't list them all. Barrett Station, Douglas Community, Deep, Elm, Dallas, Ellis Alley, Elm Thicket, Houston, Freedman, or that's in Houston, Independence Heights. Look, this is all online. This is a lot, man. Virginia, you got Pocahontas Island. Virginia, you also had Freedman's Village, which is now National Arlington Cemetery. And Canada, I'm looking at about 2, 4, 6. One of them, Wildwood. Let me read this. Okay, Wildwood, Alberta. History. Originally named Junkins, Wildwood, Alberta, Canada, in 1908. It was founded by a group of 20 African-American immigrants. 20 friends. 20 friends with 40 pairs of hands. No, or 40 hands, excuse me. The pairs, too. Wildwood is a hamlet in west central Alberta, Canada, within Yellowhead County, located on the Yellowhead Highway. All right. Apparently, this place still exists. The population today is 257 people live there now. And this town was established in 1908 by 20 African-American immigrants that, man, they just wanted to get away from Jim Crow. All right. All right, well, any comments, questions, or add-ins or whatever, 619-768-2945. Let's get to the Rural Energy Foundation.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. When I say it's over, everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
Because I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yi or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old. And I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Take the bottom 20 worst communities in U.S., okay?
Okay.
Take bottom 20. I want to hear what you're going to say about this. Bottom 20. It's a required reading to read those three books before fifth grade.
Absolutely.
Let's just say we do that. And let's do the math for those kids. Bottom. It's 100,000 kids. Let's just say it's a small number, 100,000 kids. If they were required to read Richest Man in Babylon, Think and Grow Rich, As a Man Think It, right?
Right.
Before sixth grade, if they were required to read that, you think how big of a difference you think it would have made percentage-wise?
Tremendous. Tremendous.
What is tremendous on 100,000 percentage-wise?
Probably 90%.
You think that big of a number?
I think so.
That's a big number you're talking about. So let me ask you, how come our politicians aren't recommending kids to read books?
Well,
how come we're not recommending some of these books for us to read?
Well, a lot of them don't really know the community. They never go in the community. We have people making decisions for us that has never been in the community. Like, we have people who make laws that have never been to a jail. Like, how can you tell how much time a person should spend in prison when you've never been to the prison. You don't know what it's like to go to prison. They never come to our communities. They never get out to
meet. You think you have to go to jail to be able to know how to influence you? No. I mean, it's kind of like saying, I'm a gynecologist, but I'm a man. I've never had a kid. The reason why I don't want to use that is because they'll use that as an excuse. What I'm saying is, why aren't they creating opportunity? Myself, okay, I'm a math kid. At a 1.8 GPA in high school, okay? If I was in your community, I'm probably running with you.
Right.
But my savior was Army, because a guy named Jesus Guerin came and told me, says, you're headed towards that side, probably part of your life. And he signed me up for the Army. I went to the Army. Life changed.
Right.
I was working at Burger King. I'm like a regular guy doing nothing, right? But the reason why I asked that is I'm trying to see, one, I rarely ever hear any campaign, any politician talk about, let's have our kids read the right books.
They don't. They don't. I totally agree. I mean, even my book, I've had teachers read my book, and they ask me, why am I so blunt in my book? And I said, because our kids are tired of BS.
Yeah, and I remember I read The Richest Man in Babylon. That was the one out of the three that I read.
That's the only one you read?
That's the only one out of the three that you mentioned that I read. But I've read a lot of books in general.
You're slipping.
I'm slipping? Well, I'm going to read the other two. I'm going to read the other two now that I see your breakdown. But there was a whole thing about The Richest Man in Babylon. Like the guy that became a slave and ended up buying himself out of slavery and becoming rich at the end.
Literally, he could have ran Babylon if he wanted to.
Right. But before he basically ended up in slavery, he had owed a whole bunch of people money.
No, that's a different one.
Oh, it's a different one?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the camel trader.
The camel trader. Okay. You know something better than I do. But I remember in that particular story.
I read it 25 times.
Okay. I read it once. Or maybe twice. But in that story, he was saying how when you owe a whole bunch of people money and have a bunch of debt, you're really a slave anyways. You're in a slave mentality.
Well, most people are slaves anyway because they spend all the money that they make.
Exactly.
Every time they make money, they got to go, you know, pay Michael Jordan. They got to pay the rent man, the car guy, everybody. He said, fool, you're paying everybody but yourself.
Exactly.
So, yeah. But that's not the one that I like the best. My best story is The Luckiest Man in Babylon.
Right. Next book, Think and Grow Rich. What is it about that book?
Well, Think and Grow Rich, what he taught me is that you could think your way into a position, but the best part is the mastermind group, how you take yourself and you put these different people around you that do things that you're not good at. I was doing that already, you know, when I was in the drug game. I was already putting around, but I didn't really understand how I could target people. Like right now, I target people. I specifically go after certain people, almost like a football team goes after a running back. Now I'm going after people to in places that I want them in. And I'm doing that consciously, more consciously than I was when I was in the drug business. So those are really the two key points that I learned. I also learned about the burning desire. A burning desire is, basically, a burning desire is what I had in the drug business, where I was willing to die or kill to continue to sell drugs. So that would be considered a burning desire, which Napoleon said you should never do either one of those. You shouldn't put your life or your freedom on the line, you know, to be successful.
Yeah.
And that's what I was telling you about these other guys. Once they find out that if they put that same type of energy into these other businesses, that they're going to thrive.
Oh, yeah. If you don't wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is think about your business and check to see what happened while you were asleep and strategize based on those moves, you're probably in the wrong business. You agree?
I agree.
Yeah.
I dream about my business at night.
Yeah. And the final book is As a Man Thinketh, which I've actually never heard of.
No?
No. Tell me what it is about that book.
Well, that book taught me that my mind is a muscle, and that if I exercise it, that it would grow. Just like if I took a weight and started lifting my arm, my bicep would grow, where my muscle and my mind would grow, that our mind is a muscle, and that it's like a garden. And with a garden, if you don't clean it, weeds will overtake the garden.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
有多少数量？三千个是吧？三千个赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。
好的，一点都整上来送掉。
对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call, now the grill factory is low on a crucial component.Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year.But Yupa wants more.
好，前几座前几座，加油，扛起，扛起，看，站好，
好，
好，
好。
Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war.
好，起站，
动作快点，地板下面扫一下，让地板脏兮兮的都不会扫，先叫上来。
后面的快点。
By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers.This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order.On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on.
那这样的话，那个我先提一袋先回去，然后那边先紧急生产。好，然后等一下你就赶快送过去。好 ，OK， 好，谢谢。
Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news.
小叶，小叶，小六，
这么晚才来？
没吧，这边已经那个模具刚刚才修好。抱歉，抱歉，抱歉。
He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-Yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work. And there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupap and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed.
Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin, and Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Li expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced.
Oh,
In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai,
Many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.